And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, I'm Marcia Trainer, and today I'll be reading from the book Oliver Hyde's Dishcloth Concert by Richard Kennedy. Now, maybe it's sad and maybe it's spooky, but there was a man who lived just out of town on a scrubby farm, and nobody had seen his face for years. If he was outside working, he'd keep his hat pulled down and his collar turned up. If anybody approached him, he'd run up the hill to his house and shut himself inside. He left notes pinned to the door for a brave errand boy who brought him supplies from town. The people had asked the boy what he heard in that tomb-like house when he collected the notes and brought the supplies. "Darkness and quietness," said the boy. "I hear darkness and quietness." Sometimes the children would come out of town and sing a little song up at the house, and then they'd run away. They sang, "The beautiful bride of Oliver Hyde fell down dead on a mountainside." Yes, it was true. The man was full of grief and bitterness. He was Oliver Hyde, and his young bride's wagon had been washed into a canyon by a mudslide, killed her, horse and all. But that was years ago. The children would sing some more. "Oliver Hyde's a strange old man. He sticks his head in a coffee can. He hides his face when there's folks about. He's outside in and he's inside out." It was too bad. Oliver used to have lots of friends. He played the fastest and sweetest fiddle in the county. For the few short weeks he was married, his playing was sweeter than ever. But on the day his wife was buried, he busted his fiddle across the porch post. Now he sat cold, dark, and silent on his little hill. No one had visited him for years. There was a reason, and you'll see. One day a man came out of town and walked up the hill toward Oliver's house. He was carrying a fiddle case under his arm, and two or three times he stopped and looked up at the house and shook his head, as if trying to free himself from a ghost. Then he'd continue on. He arrived at the porch steps, and all the window shades were pulled down. It was dead quiet inside. The three porch steps creaked like cats moaning in their dreams, and the man knocked on the door. For a little while it was quiet, and then there was a sound of a chair being scooted across the floor, and a voice said, "Come in." The man opened the door a crack and peeked inside. "Oliver? It's me, Jim." No answer. Jim opened the door a little farther and put a foot inside. It was dark and smelled stale, so he opened the door all the way. Off in the corner where light didn't touch sat a figure in a chair perfectly upright with his hands on his knees, like some stone god, as still and silent as 1,000 years ago. The head was draped completely with a dishcloth, and not even a breath ruffled that ghost head. Jim swallowed and spoke. "Haven't seen you around lately, Oliver." No answer. People used to visit Oliver for a while after his beautiful bride fell down dead on the mountainside. But this was how it was. Oliver just sitting there in the dark with a dishcloth over his head. And he never spoke to him. It was just too strange. His friends stopped visiting. Now all Jim wanted was a single word from Oliver. Yes or no. He had a favor to ask. He was Oliver's oldest friend, so he moved inside. "Sue's getting married, Oliver." No answer. "You remember my little girl, Sue? Why, she's all grown up now, Oliver. She's mighty pretty, too." For all the notice he got, Jim might just as well have been talking to a stove. He cleared his throat and went on. "Now, the reason I came, Oliver, was to ask you to come and play the fiddle for us at the dance. Now, we was best friends, and I just don't see how I could marry off Sue without you being there to fiddle for us. You can just say yes or no, Oliver." Now, Oliver wasn't dead himself yet, and he still had feelings. Jim had been his best friend. They had played and fought together, hunted and fished together, why, they'd grown up together. So Oliver hated to say no, just flat out like that. So instead he said, "No fiddle." Jim was prepared for that. He laid the fiddle case down on the floor and flipped it open. "Here, I brought a fiddle, Oliver. Porky Fellows was happy to make a lend of it." Oliver felt trapped now. He was silent for a long time, and then finally he said, "Tell you what, I can't wear this dishcloth on my head and fiddle. But if everyone else wears a dishcloth, I'll come." Jim was quiet for a long time, and at last he said, "All right, Oliver. I'll ask if they'll do it. Now, the dance is tomorrow night at Edward and Spar, and I'll leave the fiddle here, and if I don't come back to pick it up, then you got to come down to the dance and fiddle for us. I got your promise." Oliver smiled under the dishcloth. They'd be fools to agree to that. You can't have any fun with a dishcloth over your head. "So long, Oliver," Jim said. But Oliver didn't answer. Jim went back on down the hill. Oliver took the dishcloth off, and the fiddle was lying in the light of the open door. He sucked a whisker and looked at it. Oliver knew the fiddle. It was a good fiddle. He wondered if it was in tune and wanted to pick it up, but he let it lay there. His foot was tapping. He slapped his knee to make it stop. He laughed to himself and muttered, "Them donkeys, what do they know?" Then he got up and moved around the little house on his dreary business. The sun went down, and the shadow of the fiddle case stretched across the floor. Oliver's eyes kept landing on the fiddle, and he stepped over the shadow when he crossed that way. It looked to him like the bow had new horsehair on it. But it didn't make any difference to him. He figured he'd never be playing on that fiddle, so he never touched it. The next morning, Oliver watched down the hill for Jim to come and tell him the deal was off and to get the fiddle. Noon came, and Oliver ate some beans. Afternoon came, and Jim didn't show. Oliver began to get mad. He was mad he'd ever made that promise. It started to get dark. "Those cluckheads," Oliver said. "They can't dance with dishcloths on their heads or drink punch either. They'll have a rotten time." But a promise is a promise. Finally, he decided it was time to put on his hat and coat. "They tricked me," Oliver grumbled. "But I got a trick for them, too. They'll be sorry I came to their party." It wasn't a great trick Oliver had in mind. Just a miserable little one to make sure nobody would have any fun while he was there. Figured they'd ask him to leave shortly. He wouldn't even bother to take off his hat and coat. He headed down the hill with a fiddle under his arm and into the little town. And he entered Edward's barn with his hat pulled down and his collar turned up. It was dark except for two bare hanging light bulbs, one over the center of the barn and one at the end where a sort of stage was built up. Oliver played at shindigs there many times, and he kept his head down, and only from the corner of his eyes could he see all the people sitting around the walls. "Lord, it's awfully dark," he thought, "and quiet. Well, I figure they know that's the way I like it." He got under the light bulb that hung over the stage and took out the fiddle. He tuned down to a fretful and lonesome sound, and then he played. Of course, he knew they were all looking for happy dancing tunes, so first off he played a slow and sad tune about a man who was walking down a long road that had no ending and was gray all about. The man was looking forward to being dead because it might be more cheerful. Nobody danced, naturally, and didn't even clap when Oliver finished it. "That's just right," Oliver thought. "I'll give him a wretched time." And he started on another. The second tune he played was even slower and sadder, about a man who thought his heart was a pincushion, and it seemed to him everybody was sticking pins and needles into it. It was hurtful even to listen to it. Nobody danced, and nobody even moved to the punch bowl to get their spirits up. "Now they're sorry I came," Oliver thought. Still, he had played that last tune especially sweet, and he expected someone might just have clapped a little, even if it was sad. Oliver looked out under his hat as he retuned a bit. He tried to see Jim. He ought to come up and say hello, at least, not just let him stand there completely alone. And he wondered where the other musicians were. Four people were sitting down off to the right of the stage. That'd be them. Oliver considered it'd be nice to have a little slide guitar in these slow ones, sort of mournful played, and a mouth harp and mandolin would fit in nice. "Nah, that's just the way I want it. One more gloomy song and they'll ask me to leave." So then he played another. This one was about a man who had a wife that just recently moved on to heaven, and how roses grew all over her tombstone, even in the wintertime. Oliver was halfway through that before he remembered that he'd played that tune at his own wedding party. He pulled up short a bit then, but kept on playing it out, and a tear rolled down his cheek. Well, nobody could see. He wiped his eyes when he was finished. Nobody clapped and nobody moved, just sat there against the dark walls, perfectly still. Among the dark figures was a lighter shape, probably the bride in her white gown. Oliver remembered how lovely and happy his own bride had been. He felt a little mean when he thought about that, giving out such sad tunes. He spoke out loud the first words that were spoken since he came in. "Well, I guess you're all ready for me to leave now, and I will. But first I want to play just one happy tune for the bride, so you can dance, and then I'll go." Then he did play a happy one, a fast one, carrying on with fiddling lively enough to scramble eggs. But nobody got up to dance. And when he was finished, nobody moved or made a sound. "Look here," said Oliver. "I reckon you can't dance with those dishcloths over your heads. I forgot about that, so take them off. I'll give you another dancing tune, then I'll go." And then he went into another as sweet and light and fast as anyone ever could, something to get even a rock up in dancing. But nobody moved. And when he was finished, they all sat silent with the dishcloths still in their heads. "Come on," said Oliver. "Take those things off your heads. You other fellows, get up here with your music and help me out. Let's have some dancing. Drink a little punch. Let's get alive now. He stomped his foot 3 times and threw into a tune that would churn butter all by itself. But the other 4 musicians sat perfectly still, and so did everybody else. And Oliver was standing there under the light bulb in silence when he finished the tune. He stood there with his head down, understanding things and how it felt to be on the other side of the darkness and silence when all you wanted was some sign of life to help out. Then he leaned over and put the fiddle in the case and closed it. He said one last thing and then walked out from under the light toward the door. "Okay," he said. "That's a hard lesson, but I got it." When he opened the door, he bumped into someone sitting next to it against the wall, and the fellow fell off his chair. Oliver put a hand down to help him up, but the fellow just lay there. And Oliver touched him. "What's this?" He felt around, then shoved back his hat for a look. It was a sack of grain he'd knocked over. And the next person sitting there was a sack of grain, too. And the next was a bale of hay. Oliver walked completely around the barn, and all the people were sacks of grain or bales of hay sitting there against the dark walls. The bride was a white sack of flour. The 4 musicians sitting off to the right of the stage, they were 4 old saddles setting on a rail. When Oliver came around to the door again, he heard music, and he stepped outside and looked down the street. A barn down near the end was all lit up, and lots of people were moving about. So he went back up on the stage and got the fiddle and headed down the street. Jim was standing by the door. "Waiting for you, Oliver," he said. "We're just getting underway. Come on in." When he led Oliver inside, everyone became quiet. First one little group of people, then another, till at last everyone was silent and looking at Oliver. The bride and groom were holding hands. Jim made a motion, and everyone headed for a chair against the walls, and they all took out dishcloths and put them over their heads. "Edward's got himself a new barn, huh?" Oliver said. "Yeah, oh, I guess you didn't know that, huh? Uses the old one to store stuff. I should have told you." "Oh, it's all right," said Oliver. He looked up on the stage. 4 musicians were sitting there with dishcloths over their heads. Then Jim took out a large dishcloth, but Oliver touched him on the arm. "Never mind that, and everyone else, too. Just be regular and dance. I'll fiddle for you." Jim slapped him on the back and shouted out the good news. Oliver went up on stage, and someone got him a mug of punch. Musicians tuned up, and Oliver took off his hat and dropped it, tossed his coat on a chair. Why, they lit into a fast and happy tune. They danced and played and sang half the night, and they had a wonderful time, including Oliver. You've been listening to a story from the book Oliver Hyde's Dishcloth Concert, published by Little Brown. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye, the executive producer is Carla Tanella, and I'm Marcia Traynor.
Now, it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm June Pennell Stevens. Today I'll be reading the book Wee Gillis by Monroe Leaf. Wee Gillis lived in Scotland. His real name was Alastair Roderick Craigellachie Dalhousie Gowan Donnybristle McMack. But that took too long to say, so everybody just called him Wee Gillis. His mother's relations were all lowlanders. They stayed down in the valleys and raised long-haired cows. His father's relations were all highlanders. They stayed up in the hills and stalked stags. Wee Gillis didn't know which he wanted to be, a lowlander or a highlander. His mother's relations all thought that his father's relations were very foolish to run and climb and creep around the hills stalking stags. His father's relations all thought that his mother's relations were very silly to drive and call and milk their long-haired cows. Wee Gillis didn't know, but he watched them both, and he was cheerful and amiable. So for 1 year, he went to live in the lowlands with his mother's relations. Every day he rose early and ate a large bowl of oatmeal. Then he drove the long-haired cows out along the valleys, and at night he called and called them, and drove them home again in time for his mother's relations to milk them. Once he was late in getting them home. Then all the relations asked him what had kept him, and he had to tell them that the cows wouldn't come when he called. Then the relations all said that he didn't shout loud enough, and that the cows couldn't hear him through the heavy mist. So every night when the mists would come down over the valleys, Wee Gillis would shout a little louder than he had before. That was very fine for his lungs, and by the end of the year they were very, very strong. On the first day of the new year, Wee Gillis went up into the highlands. Every day he rose early and ate a large bowl of oatmeal with his father's relations. Then he set out walking and crawling, running and creeping all over the hills, stalking stags. He would hide behind thistles and sit on the heather, and sometimes he would have to be so quiet for hours at a time that you would have thought he was a stone. Once, while he was stalking, he sighed a big sigh, because he had stayed still for so long. And the noise that it made frightened a stag so that it ran away. Then all the relations told Wee Gillis that he didn't keep quiet enough, and that he must learn to hold his breath. So day after day, sitting among the thistles and on the heather, Wee Gillis would hold his breath longer and longer to keep from sighing, so he wouldn't frighten the stags. That was fine for his lungs, and by the end of the year they were very, very strong. So year in and year out, Wee Gillis would take turns calling the cows in the lowlands and stalking the stags in the highlands, and all the while his lungs grew stronger and stronger. At last the day came when he would make up his mind and decide forever which to be, a lowlander who called cows or a highlander who stalked stags. Bright and early in the morning, there were two loud knocks on his door. When he opened it, there stood his Uncle Andrew from the lowlands and his Uncle Angus from the highlands. Gillis put on his kilt in a hurry, and away they went out into the morning. They walked and walked, not saying a word, down through the valleys and up over the hills, until they found just the right spot for deciding. Then his Uncle Andrew and his Uncle Angus stopped and stood very still. They turned to Wee Gillis. He was exactly halfway up the side of a medium-sized hill, not in the lowlands and not in the highlands, just in the middle, and he had to choose forever. Gillis looked down, and Gillis looked up. Then he looked at his uncles, and they began to talk. First they pleaded, and then they begged very softly and very quietly, one at a time, and they politely waited for each to finish what he had to say before the other began. But still Wee Gillis could not decide. So the uncles' voices grew louder and louder, and they didn't wait for each other to finish talking any more, but they shouted and screamed and yelled until they jumped up and down and stamped their feet. You could hear them shouting all the way down in the valleys and all the way up in the hills. Suddenly, his uncle stopped jumping and shouting because a very large man had come up behind them. He was carrying something brown and big, but he'd put it down beside a rock, and then he looked at Wee Gillis, and then at Uncle Andrew, and then at Uncle Angus. When they were very quiet, he sat down on a rock. He picked up the big brown thing that looked like a sack with sticks on it, and took a deep breath, and puffed his cheeks, and shut his eyes, and blew into one end of it with all his might. But nothing happened. He shook his head sadly and tried again, but nothing happened. And then he was very sad, and he said so. He was almost ready to cry, because he was a bagpiper, and he had just made these fine new bagpipes to play on, but he had made them too big, and he didn't have enough breath to blow them. Uncle Andrew was sorry for him, so he tried to blow them too, but he couldn't. Uncle Angus was sorry for him, so he tried to blow them, but he couldn't either. So they all sat down on rocks and were sad together. Wee Gillis wished that his uncles would ask him to try. But they didn't, so he just stood and looked as though he would like to. After a long time, the large man noticed him and shook his head slowly, but because Wee Gillis looked so wanting to, the large man asked him if he would like to try. Wee Gillis said, "Aye." So he did. First, he took a deep breath the way he used to when he was going to call the cows on a misty night in the lowlands. Then he held it the way he used to when he was sitting very still, stalking stags in the highlands. And then he blew with all the force in his very, very strong lungs. The bag filled up and let out a screech through every one of its pipes. And the large man and Uncle Andrew and Uncle Angus fell off their rocks with surprise. So the large man taught him how to make music. And now Wee Gillis is welcome down in the lowlands and up in the highlands. But most of the time, he just stays in his house halfway up the side of a medium-sized hill and plays the biggest bagpipes in all Scotland. You've been listening to the book Wee Gillis by Munro Leaf, published by Viking Press. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inua. The executive producer is Carla Tonella, and I'm June Pinnell Stevens.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Good morning. I'm Tom Hassler, and today I'll be reading from the book The Dancing Tigers by Russell Hoban. The Raja was out hunting on his elephant. He was hunting tigers. The Raja's elephant was painted in purple and ochre and vermilion. It was hung with velvet and jewels and tasseled with silk. The Raja's elephant had a telephone and a bar and a new stereotape cassette player. The Raja talked to his office on the telephone, and he listened to light classics on his new stereo tape cassette player. in a rack within easy reach, were the Raja's monogrammed, gold-mounted, jeweled tiger guns. Many rounds of ammunition were in boxes, inlaid with ivory and mother-of-pearl at his feet. A servant stood by in the gilded howdah, ready to reload the guns as fast as the Raja could fire them, while another servant mixed drinks at the bar. Trackers and beaters went through the jungle ahead and behind. The tigers had no stereotape cassette players and no telephones. They didn't wear shoes. They were primitive. They had no guns. Whenever they killed anything, they got all bloody. Ah, but they could dance. Nobody danced like the tigers. Nobody could even think of such dances as they did. Moon dances, shadow dances, silence dances, and dances for the starlight and the glimmers on the river. Even the child tigers among them danced the most complex patterns and difficult rhythms in the bending grasses, and the shadows of the jungle under the hissing and humming of the moon, under the racing clouds, under the teeming rain. Nobody knew of their dancing. Nobody had ever heard of it or imagined such a thing. And the tigers held their tongues. Silently, prowling in their stripes, they hunted. Unseen, they roared and started sudden echoes. They knew they would be hunted down. They knew that every season, some of them would die by a bullet from the Raja's monogrammed, gold-mounted, jeweled tiger guns. They were primitive and patient, and they accepted their lot. When the Raja came into the jungle on his elephant, there was sorrow among the tigers. Families huddled together, cursing and praying by turns. Fathers and mothers wept over their children soon to be orphans. There was nowhere to escape to, only other jungles and other Rajas. The tigers had little to hope for. They posted sentries, and they waited. From the outpost came the word that the Raja on his elephant was coming closer. The tigers cursed and prayed and waited. From the outposts came the word that the Raja had a new stereotape cassette player on which he played light classics.
"What are light classics?" said one of the tiger elders. His question was relayed to the outposts.
"You will know them when you hear them," came the answer. "Only light classics have the sound of light classics."
The tigers waited. The elder said,
"This too may perhaps be born. If it is our fate to be killed by the Raja, then die we must. Perhaps he sees the tragedy of the thing. Perhaps he is saddened that all unknowing he stills our dancing that he has never seen and is not even capable of imagining. Perhaps he senses this and does us honor in this fashion." Then they heard the cries of birds that flew up from the trees as the Raja came through the jungle on his elephant that was painted purple and ochre and vermilion. From the new stereotape cassette player, they heard the blare of music in the dappled sunlight and deep shadow of the jungle. It was Hippolytov Ivanov's Caucasian Sketches. "What the deuce is that?" said all the tigers. "That's light classics," said the elder. "There's no mistaking it. I'll tell you what this is. It's simply too much. It's one thing to accept one's fate, but it's quite another thing to perish with light classics shattering the stillness. It's insulting. It's degrading. Hear, hear, shouted most of the tigers. Very few hung back. Now listen to me, said the elder. My whole world picture has suddenly changed. As long as the Raja knew his place, it seemed to me that I knew mine. But now I can't think how I could have been such a fool. I'll tell you what I'm thinking. What? Said all the tigers. I'm thinking of dancing him to death, said the elder. Him and his trackers and his beaters, his mahout and his servants, the whole ruddy lot of them. Well, there it is, said all the tigers. Why not? It's certainly no worse than hanging about and being shot down. The tigers stopped praying, and they stopped cursing. In what little time they had until the beaters were upon them, they quickly decided who should dance what. Then they wished one another luck and got on with it. They didn't wait to hear the gongs and shouts of the beaters. They called for volunteers and sent the first one out to dance. They counted heavily on the element of surprise. The Raja had his rifle at ready. He expected to see a running tiger. He did not expect a dancing one. He did not fire immediately. The first tiger volunteer was a female, cool and brave and elegant. She fixed her amber eyes upon the Raja, and she wove herself into and out of the shadows as she danced the stillness of the jungle that waits.
Ah, said the Raja, there never was such dancing. And then he shut off the stereo tape cassette player so he could see it better.
Better not watch, said his mahout. You'll be sorry if you do.
I've never seen the like, the Raja said. I'd no idea that tigers were up to this sort of thing. And he laid down his rifle, leant his chin on his hand, and watched. While the first tiger was still dancing, a second one came out to join her. A powerful male, he danced the terror of the jungle that is partner to the stillness. The Raja was enchanted.
Primitive they may be, he said, but they've got something. They really have.
Tell you what, said the mahout, I'd like to put this elephant in reverse and clear out of here.
No, indeed, the Raja said. I feel as if I've waited all my life for this. It must have been the music that got them started. It's quite amazing, really. I shall write a letter to the Times about this.
The Raja watched. The tigers danced. Other tigers, one by one, came from the shadows dancing. The sun went down. The moon rose over the dancing tigers, and the Raja watched while the mahout shivered and hid his face. The night wore on, and all the tigers danced now, old and young, the grown ones and the children. They danced the moon dance and the shadow dance and the dance for the starlight and the glimmers on the river. Under the hissing and the humming of the moon, under the racing clouds, they danced. They danced the moon down low and pale into the morning. Some perhaps were moved to pity, but they could not stop.
The dance was in them, and they danced it. In the dawn, the birds sang the morning stillness into day, but the Raja never heard them, nor his mahout, nor his servants, and his trackers, and his beaters. The Raja still leant his chin on his hand, but as the elephant turned and walked back out of the jungle, he fell forward. His head struck the play button of the stereotape cassette player, and he rode back to his palace, dead, while the swaying elephant alone heard the Caucasian sketches of Hippolytov Ivanov. You've been listening to The Dancing Tigers by Russell Hulban, published in the United Kingdom by Jonathan Cape. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillian. The executive producer is Carla Tonella. And I'm Tom Hasler.
Now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Whitcher. Today I'll be reading from The Maid of the North, Feminist Folk Tales from Around the World by Ethel Johnston Phelps. The Giant's Daughter, a Scandinavian tale. A long time ago, giants and trolls dwelt in the high mountain forests above the northern fjords. They kept to themselves and had little to do with the people who lived in the valley below, except to scare the wits out of one of them now and then. Gina was different. She was quite curious about the humans living in the little houses down in the valley and along the shore. Of course, she was still young, as giants go, and not fully grown. That would explain her foolishness, thought her father. She has the curiosity of a bear cub, grumbled her mother. But it's very unnatural to bother with humankind. Have nothing to do with people, advised the elder giants. Small, stupid creatures, frightened by a boulder thrown or a sheep carried off. Nonetheless, on clear days, young Gina would sit on a rock at the lower edge of the forest, watching the people below go about their daily work. It seemed to Gina that these people had a splendid time. The maidservants especially caught her attention, moving about from dairy to stream, laughing together as they worked. Oh, the work is so easy. I could do it with one hand, thought she. And so many kinds of food just for the taking. Gina, it must be admitted, was just a little greedy. She loved to eat. She was also quite stubborn. Once she had made up her mind to go down to the village below, no one could dissuade her. Her cousins, the mountain trolls, shrilled, "But they're our enemy! You'll be killed, and it will serve you right!" "Oh, you foolish child," cried her mother in alarm. "Mark my words, there will be trouble. No good will come of it." "Oh, no good will come of it," warned the uncles, the aunts, and all the rest of the giants. But they were all quite wrong. One day, Gina, hop-skipping over the boulders, came down the mountain to the village. At the first two houses where she stopped to ask for work, she had no luck at all. At the third house, the mistress looked at the very tall, strongly built girl with a large, round head and thought, "Here's a bargain indeed, an odd-looking country girl, but she'll do very well for chopping wood and pounding the wash," and she told Gina to come in. Gina bent down, ducking her head to enter the house. "Oh, such queer, tiny houses," thought she. "Doorways much too small and roofs much too low for comfort." Gina was set to work at once, but it was not many days before the mistress regretted having taken in the strange girl. Gina chopped wood with a will, but so violently that the chunks flew in all directions. One struck a rooster stone dead, and one sent a dog yowling off in surprise. Another whacked a cart horse so sharply that he bolted off, spilling rounds of cheese right and left. And then she carried such huge armloads of wood into the house that the door burst off its hinges. Set to work with a tub of wash at the stream, she pounded the laundry so thoroughly that all the clothes and linens came out in rags. And to make matters worse, Gina ate more than all the other servants put together. Even between meals, she found her way into the storeroom and sat happily devouring jars of honey, vats of pickles, and long strings of sausages. The mistress brought this tale of woe to her husband, a merchant. "She's impossible," cried the mistress. "We must get rid of her. When she scours pots, she grinds holes in them, and when she washes dishes, she breaks half of them. If she sits on my chairs, they collapse. No, I can't keep her a day longer. She'll be the ruin of us." But if Gina was greedy about food, the merchant was miserly about money. "She's powerfully strong, and we pay her no wages," he pointed out to his wife, for Gina knew nothing of money or wages. "We could never get a village girl to work for us without payment. And where could we find one half so strong? Gina's twice as strong as a man. I'll find work for her." So, although the mistress complained bitterly about the havoc Gina caused and wanted to get rid of her at once, the merchant insisted she be kept on. He set Gina to heavy outdoor work, carrying bales of hay to the barn. But Gina thought it fun to toss the bales into the hayloft, and if she knocked down a farmhand in the process, she merely roared with laughter. If a horse kicked her, she gave the animal a powerful kick right back. All this caused such an uproar in the barnyard that the merchant quickly set Gina to unloading the fishing boats that came to his wharf. Here she did the work of two or three men. Delighted with such a strong and willing worker, the merchant used Gina everywhere, from sausage and cheese making to building a new storage barn. In the new barn, he had Gina build a room and bed of her own, for the mistress declared she was not fit to live in a house. The merchant, however, rubbed his hands in satisfaction, thinking of the money he saved. And what about Gina? Gina was enjoying herself. The heavy work did not bother her at all. She joined in the village dances, but she swung her partners with such vigor that they whirled away across the field. After that, partners were hard to find. Still, everything new fascinated her. Although she thought humans most peculiar in their ways, she marveled at their cleverness. Their houses were too small and their furniture too flimsy. But it was fine to sleep on a bed instead of a pile of leaves, or use an axe to chop wood instead of breaking it apart with her hands. And to think, one might keep chickens to have eggs whenever one wished. Her sharp, inquisitive eyes took in everything that went on around her. Things went on in this way for several months. But while the merchant became more and more pleased with his bargain, the mistress became more and more irritated with Gina. She determined to get rid of her. In the spring, the merchant prepared to sail down to Bergen on a trading voyage. His wife announced that she would go with him. And just before they set sail, she took Gina aside and said sharply, "I don't want to find you here when we return. I advise you to go back to wherever you came from." Then she quickly joined her husband aboard the ship, and they sailed away down the fjord with a stiff breeze. Gina was left on shore with the village folk who had turned out to see the merchant off. Next to her stood two maidservants from the village. "Wish you were going with them," said one. "Save the money they pay you, Gina, and you can go to Bergen yourself some day." "Money they pay me?" repeated Gina in surprise. "Your wages for working," said the other. "I noticed you never spend any money. You must have a nice little sum hidden away." "They never gave me any money for working." The two girls laughed at her. "Oh, you are a green one. You worked almost a year for nothing." "Greedy old man," said the other. "No wonder he's so rich." When Gina finally understood that all the other country girls were paid, her eyes became quite red with anger. She stalked back to the merchant's place, and there she sat down and thought for a long time. "Payment I shall have," she said finally. "I'll take it myself." At once she set to work. She pulled out an old cart from the barn and loaded it with all the things she had decided to take with her. In went a cock and a hen, an axe, nails. She knew what she needed for the success of her plan. And when the cart was filled, she didn't forget to toss in a round wheel of cheese, a crock of pickles, and several strings of her favorite sausages. Then she pulled the loaded cart up the mountain until she reached the high pine forests, the land of the trolls and giants. Swinging the axe with gusto, she soon converted trees into the framework of a tall one-room house. She made sure that the doorway was big and wide, and the roof high enough for a full-grown giant. Next to it was a fenced-in yard for the cock and hen. From time to time, the giants and trolls came by to watch her work and to gape in astonishment at so much mad activity. "Poor Gina," they said to each other. "She's become as crazy as a loon living with humans all that time. I knew no good would come of it." "She'll never marry now," lamented Gina's mother. "She's collected no fur pelts for dowry. What sensible giant would want that pile of wood?" But again, they were all quite wrong. When Gina had finished all her work, the first frost sparkled on the ground, and the smell of snow was in the air. She now had a tall house made of logs, snug against the winter cold. She had an open hearth and a stack of firewood, a big, solid chair, a large bed covered with fur pelts, chickens safely housed in a lean-to, rounds of cheese made from wild goat and reindeer milk, sausages and wild boar hams hanging from the rafters. By the time the heavy snow had settled on the mountain, even the sour trolls had to admit that a warm log house was better than a cave or a deep underground hole. It dawned on the folk of the forest that Gina was not crazy at all. She was, in fact, very clever. And what better dowry could a young giant girl have than a snug hut and strings of fragrant sausages? All the giant folk now called her Clever Gina. And as the winter thawed into spring, Gina was besieged with offers to marry. "Perhaps I'll marry, perhaps I won't," she said carelessly. "I'll think about it." And since the young giants were very eager to bring her rabbits or wild boar and other game in exchange for eggs, cheese, or the loan of her axe, it seemed to Gina that thinking about it was a very good arrangement indeed. You've been listening to a story from the book The Maid of the North, Feminist Folk Tales from Around the World by Ethel Johnston Phelps, published by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tonella. And I'm Ellen Whitcher. Thank you.